Charlie Cole Hayes, and The Greatest Voyage, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. And when you talk about adventures across our solar system, your mind naturally turns to the Voyager mission, now exploring interstellar space. Our guest this week led the team that figured out how Voyagers 1 and 2 could weave their way among the outer planets and onward toward infinity. Bill Nye calls in from Canada to talk about something that is shared by millennials and the President of the United States, excitement about getting humans to Mars. And Bruce Batts will help me give away another copy of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe. Emily Lakdawalla is the Planetary Society's senior editor. Emily, as you said in your blog entry last week on October 11th, it was a very busy week, and the one that we're entering doesn't seem far behind.
The one that we're entering includes a big meeting of the Division for Planetary Sciences of the American Astronomical Society, as well as the European Planetary Science Congress. But that's not the biggest action this week. The biggest action is the arrival of ExoMars at Mars, and that's going to be real exciting.
Now that these two spacecraft have sort of kissed each other goodbye and gone their separate ways, quite literally, what happens next?
Well, the two spacecraft are only on very slightly different trajectories, and that has to change, or else ExoMars would follow Schiaparelli right down onto the surface, and that would be bad. So about 12 hours after the separation, they planned a very small rocket firing to adjust ExoMars's path so that it just misses Mars and is in a good position to fire its rockets on Wednesday in order to enter orbit.
A lot of people very curious, of course, about Schiaparelli. I'm trying to pronounce that with the proper Italian pronunciation of it. The instrumentation on it, but it's really not a mission that's about science, is it?
No, it's an entry demonstration module. Europe has not landed a mission on Mars before, and it plans to land a really big rover in a few years. So this mission is simply designed to test a number of key technologies that they'll be using. The spacecraft is battery operated and is only expected to last a few days on the surface before going silent. The real science mission here is ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter.
Emily, I expect to be in the room at the DPS meeting where they will be doing the live stream as Schiaparelli approaches Mars and sets down safely, we hope, and ExoMars goes into orbit. When can people take part in this, and how can they take part?
Well, I just posted a timeline on the blog that details all of the expected events in a few time zones, so you can follow along with that, as well as links to ESA's live stream. But probably Twitter is going to be just as good for you to follow the events. There are four official Twitter accounts, and then, of course, space fans around the world are going to be collecting online to cheer ExoMars on as it enters orbit, and Schiaparelli hopefully turns on and sends us its signals, and we can follow it all the way down to the Martian surface.
You bet. And I look forward to seeing you at DPS, Emily.
I'll be there with bells on.
She's our senior editor, the planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine and DPS, one of her favorite times of year. We're going to go on to talking with the boss, the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science guy. And Bill is on the phone this week, calling us from Alberta, Canada. Bill, what's going on up there?
The Dark Skies Festival. People come from all over Canada and a few from the U.S. for these series of talks. And I'm one of the talkers. We talk about the cosmos and our place in space and how wonderful it is.
Someone else who's talking about space, the President of the United States.
Oh, yeah, he's kind of a big deal.
For a while longer.
But he said, let's go to Mars in the 2030s. Now, Matt, who am I? I'm the happiest guy in the world, right? But the 2030s is a decade, not a date. I think what always slows us down, by us I mean humankind and those of us interested in space exploration, is we don't set a day. There's songs about setting a date. And if we don't set a day, then things don't get done. Deadlines are your friend, Matt. I believe you said that.
I said they're magic.
Even bigger. So without the specific date chosen, I just think these things have a tendency to diffuse politically. And having the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, in the lead is good. It's what you want. By not having the U.S. in the lead without a date and not having a date, there's a very good chance that politically this will just run out of steam. We at the Planetary Society will do our best to keep the steam fired up.
Did you see the Ipsos poll that indicated, among other things, 40% of millennials would volunteer for a trip to the red planet?
Now, you say that when you're a millennial and you're excited and you say, I don't even care if I don't come back, right? But when the chips are down, when shoving comes to pushing, I think millennials will want to come back.
But aren't you impressed that, you know, even if 75% of those 40...
Oh, yeah, it's the coolest thing. It's so romantic. Oh, man, it's so romantic. Yes, yes, yes. And this is what I say all the time about when Elon Musk did this presentation at the Astronautical Congress. It's the enthusiasm that's so amazing, the enthusiasm.
I'll say, and I'm sure you're going to find an enthusiastic dark sky audience up there in Canada, where we have many listeners to this program. Have fun.
Oh, yes. Yes, thank you. I will. Carry on, Matt. Good to speak with you.
That's Bill Nye. He is the science guy. We're going to talk with the guy who figured out how Voyager would be able to take a grand tour of the solar system, Charlie Colhayes. Ask space fans for their favorite robotic mission, and many will say Voyager. It's no wonder. Voyagers 1 and 2 are headed toward their 40th anniversaries in space. They gave us stunning close-up views of Jupiter, Saturn, and many of their moons. They revealed Uranus and Neptune as never before. And now, they are teaching us about the space between the stars. They carry the Voyager golden records, those magnificent greetings to the universe, from all of us on this pale blue dot. Perhaps the greatest miracle of this mission is that it has been able to accomplish so much and visit so many worlds. A good part of the credit goes to the Voyager mission design manager, Charlie Colhayes. He arrived at JPL in 1959, fresh from the U.S. Navy. He would spend more than 40 years there, working on many missions, but nothing else comes close to the pride he has in Voyager. Charlie dropped by the Planetary Society studio a few weeks ago to talk with me about Voyager and the life he has led in space exploration. You're about to hear a few excerpts from that nearly 45-minute conversation. The online version of this week's show at planetary.org/radio has much more, including Charlie's story about how the mission got its name, the tremendous challenges the Voyager team faced early in the mission, and how close he came to not taking part in it.
Many things that we do in life, in hindsight, we think of some things we might have done differently. As I look back on Voyager, there's nothing I would have done differently. I think we picked the best flight paths out of 10,000 possibilities. I mean, you have to understand, the solar system has a lot of bodies out there.
Yeah.
And they're in constant motion. So at every instant in time, they're all in a different position. And the trick with Voyager was to find launch and arrival dates that had the largest number of interesting targets in the best positions possible, while still doing gravity assist to go from Jupiter to Saturn to Uranus to Neptune. And orchestrating that was a pleasure. I mean, I jumped up, you know, got out of bed in the morning, rushed into work, and I didn't look at the clock until 5:30 or 6 o'clock.
Remind us again what a rare opportunity this was.
Well, the planets are going around at their own different periods and so forth. The alignment of Earth, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune happened about once every 176 years. Hmm. But it happened for three consecutive years before it sort of fell out of position. In other words, we could have gone in 1976, 77, and 78. But if we went in 76, we had to fly very close to get enough deflection to go on to Saturn. 1977 was sort of the Goldilocks year. In 1978, because Jupiter is overtaking Saturn, you don't want to get too much swing by. You have to fly further out.
Mm-hmm.
So the 1977 was the best year. And the interesting thing is, you know, the next opportunity will be, what, 2153. And who knows? We may not even be, what I hope we're doing is saving Earth's biodiversity. I care about that a lot more than I do.
As much as you care about the rest of the solar system.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And the last time, of course, was when the first train ran in England somewhere. So
that's a good way to
put
it.
So this is a unique opportunity for sure, the 1977 one.
I was talking just this morning with my daughter's boyfriend. And he was telling me about this app he has for his smartphone. It's basically a 3D model of the solar system. You can fly through it. It's absolutely accurate. You didn't have that 40 years ago. What tools did you have to try and figure out these incredibly complex trajectories?
Oh, how do I answer that question? Well, you basically, you still had computer programs that computed the position and velocity of the spacecraft and the different targets. We had sort of rudimentary graphics programs that were wireframe. But eventually, I had the good fortune of bringing Jim Blinn aboard.
I was going to ask you about it. I'm going to bring him up again later.
Okay. Jim and I produced the six Voyager animations. And, of course, Jim wrote all the software. He's brilliant. He's considered the father of modern computer graphics.
Not just for places like JPL,
right,
but for the movies.
Right. In fact, there's even an algorithm called Blinn shading. You know, there's different kinds. There's Phong shading. And in mm-hmm. the world of 3D modeling and animation, there are a lot of terms. And Jim has his own called Blinn shading. About that time, we were able to, and other people like Paul Pinzo and Joe Biro that I worked with, began to create good graphics. So we could fly these missions, point the scan platform, look at the targets, lay down the mosaics. So we had a pretty good feel for that.
The scan platform, of course, was that independent little platform on Voyager that allowed you to independently direct the cameras.
That's right. It slewed in cone and clock or azimuth and elevation. I can't remember the terminology anymore. But the main trick with finding the best Voyager encounters, there was a lot of interest in the moon Io at Jupiter. Scientists had seen sulfur emissions, and they figured that there might be a chance it might have some volcanoes. And, of course, the interesting moon at Saturn was Titan.
Yeah.
Titan was Carl Sagan's interest. And Io goes around Jupiter every 1.77 days. But, of course, Titan goes around Saturn every 16 days. So we're carving up this huge launch arrival date space in multiples of every 1.77 days at Jupiter because we want the swing by to still go close to Io. And then at Saturn, well, you could either fly by Titan before you went by Saturn closest approach or after. So we call the ones before Titan befores and the ones after Titan afters.
And TB and TA.
Yeah, that's right. And so the wonderful puzzle that we got to put together was examining all of these. There are two ways you can generate trajectories. One is with double precision trajectory programs that have, you know, 16 and 32 bits of precision, and they're very slow because they take time steps and they integrate. They move all the planets and the spacecraft a little bit and make very accurate computations. But it takes a long time to run a case.
Especially 40 years ago.
That's right. And so what we did is we developed fast conics. You can simulate a more precise trajectory using conic equations. Because basically, when you leave the Earth, you leave on a hyperbola, then you find yourself on an ellipse around the sun. Then as you approach the target planet, you're back on a hyperbola relative to that. And so by patching conics from one planet to the next, we could run hundreds or thousands of those cases in the time it took to run half a dozen high-precision integrated ones. So we could cover the space quickly with the conics.
These are sections of a cone, because if you do that,
right?
Put a plane through a cone and you get an ellipse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Wow. So that simplified it, but you still had 10,000
choices.
That's right. I mean, to a degree, as much as this was science and math, there seems to have been some art in this.
No, there was. I know.
Voyager Mission Design Manager Charlie Colhaze has more for us after the break. This is Planetary Radio.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Charlie Colhaes was only half his current age when Voyagers 1 and 2 departed Earth in 1977 for the outer solar system and interstellar space. The Voyager mission design manager led the team that figured out how the spacecraft could slingshot through the planets, returning data and images that are still making news and leaving viewers dumbstruck with their beauty.
Were you involved with the creation of the Golden Record with that team, with Carl Sagan and other folks?
No. No, I wasn't.
Because there's a picture of you standing next to it with a big smile, and I just wondered, did you feel good about it being part of the mission?
Oh, yeah. The thing I found the most interesting about it was the way the cover to the Golden Record was designed to allow anyone that happened to discover it to learn where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at that, you'll see that this instructional cover knew that something that was fundamental in the universe, that Carl and whoever did this design figured someone advanced enough to find Voyager would understand,
mm-hmm.
is hydrogen. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. They also put a stylus in to play the record.
Yep. Yeah.
I thought... Yeah.
So that they could decode those pictures.
Right.
You're an artist as well as a scientist.
Right.
The idea of sending works of art,
Beautiful
photos representing our planet and our civilization, That had to capture your imagination like it did so many people's.
Oh, it did. No, I'm very much a left brain science, logic, engineering, right brain artist, and so forth. And in fact, I like best projects that involve both sides of my brain. And I was totally supportive of all the things they did in that vein.
How did the artistic side of your mind, how did that mesh with the science side? Why did those work well together for you?
Well, it's funny. In the earliest days, I could visualize trajectory. If I was designing some orbit around some body, I could see it in my head in 3D, almost to scale. And I consider that the artistic side and not the scientific. The scientific side would sort of write all the equations down and, you know, generate whatever. But I could picture all of these things in my head. And I loved it. I've loved photography and you know, I eventually taught 3D modeling and animation at PCC.
Yep, and Pasadena was, City College.
If you could think of the logic flow chart on Voyager from the time we started designing it until the time we went through everything that happened, it was a beautiful path for any decision maker.
I bet. I hope that exists someplace. I hope somebody actually drew that out someplace. That would be a lot of boxes, I bet.
That's right. The conditions for Voyager 2 to continue on to Neptune, to Uranus and Neptune, were these. If Voyager 1 failed to capture the Titan science, we would retarget Voyager 2 for another Titan before. On the other hand, if it was successful, that cleared the way for Voyager 2 to use this further out aiming point at Saturn, give up Titan, pick the gravity assist corridor to go on to Uranus and Neptune, and that all worked out.
I read that sometimes you would go to bed with a problem in your head.
Oh yeah,
and you'd wake up eureka.
No, I know that. I know that sounds like BS, but that saved me a huge amount of time. That happened regularly. I would just before falling asleep, I would sort of think about a problem that hadn't been solved that day. And when I woke up the next morning, I knew the answer just like that. And it was solved in my sleep. And that really helps when you got a lot of work to do.
I'll say, yeah, man. I wonder what that dream was about. You already mentioned Jim Blinn.
Oh, yeah.
One of the artists you've worked with.
Right.
You work with Don Davis a lot, too.
Right.
Famous.
Oh, Don. Don's a wonderful person.
Space
right.
artist. Yeah.
Yeah.
You also got the chance, I think, because of what you did, to meet a lot of the greats in science fiction, another kind of art.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
I mean, you're a longtime fan.
No, Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury.
Heinlein?
Briefly. I spent a day with Neil Armstrong. So, no, I've been very fortunate in meeting the greats. I wouldn't take it back. I would want my life over again because I don't think it could have been worked out any better.
I want to thank you for taking from this unique viewpoint that you've had, particularly with Voyager, but across many years of exploration in our solar system.
Well, Matt, I appreciate it. You and I have always been friends, and I've miss seeing you at times, and other times I've enjoyed it very much, and I hope we continue to have this relationship. I have a lot of respect for you. You're doing a wonderful job, and you scored some points with my daughter that time. She said, "Geez, Dad, he knows who you are." So it's
I'm not alone.
Yeah.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Matt, very much. I appreciate it.
Charlie Colhaze, the Voyager Mission Design Manager. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. We've got the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, Dr. Bruce Betts, and he's going to fill us in. Hi there.
Hi, Matt. How you doing?
I'm very happy today. I had a nice conversation with our friend Charlie Colhaze, and looking forward to DPS next week. I'll get to spend the whole week in Pasadena, which might not excite some people, but I'm looking forward to it.
Speaking for those people, you're right.
So what's up?
Got the evening sky dominated by Venus low in the west shortly after sunset. If you look to the upper left of Venus, you will hopefully find Saturn looking kind of yellowish and a lot dimmer. And go farther to the upper left and you will find Mars looking reddish but a lot dimmer than Venus. In the pre-dawn sky, Jupiter's low in the east, coming up, getting higher over the coming weeks, easier to see right before dawn. We move on to this week in space history. It was 1967. Mariner 5 flew by Venus.
All right, another important milestone in the exploration of our solar system. What's next, as if I didn't know?
I don't know, man. I don't know. What could it be? Random space fact? This week, the Schiaparelli ESA entry, descent, lander test will be going on Mars. And I thought I'd point out to you that it was named after Giovanni Schiaparelli, Italian astronomer from the mostly 1800s. He was a big Mars observer. In fact, coined the term canali, which just meant channels, natural features in Italian, but got all scrambled coming to English and started the whole crazy there are canals on Mars thing. Also, he has a big crater named after him on Mars. It's 461 kilometers in diameter, and I'm guessing you think of it for another reason.
And why is that?
Because in The Martian, that's the crater that our hero had to get to.
Completely forgot that. Thanks, by the way, to Percival Lowell for giving us the what he thought were actual canals, leading to, over a century now of fun with Martians.
That's true.
I also, since you don't have the advantage of having heard my piece with Emily today when we talked about ExoMars and Schiaparelli, I think I got that right, or being married to an Italian woman as I am, I will just excuse it by saying you use the American pronunciation.
Yes, I apologize for any offense I caused. Schiaparelli?
Yeah, that's a big improvement. Let's go on to the contest.
Okay. We asked you, what are the names of the two asteroids that Rosetta flew by, as well as the name of the comet it studied and eventually was set down upon recently? And how'd we do, Matt?
Well, this was one of the tougher questions you've asked recently, and I think that that had its effect on the number of entries. Still, a lot more than we used to get. I think just an indication of the growing audience for this program. Would you give us the answers, please? Because I'm hoping you'll do a better job of pronouncing them.
I doubt it. Apparently, I already failed on Schiaparelli. They flew by the asteroid Steins, the very much larger asteroid Lutetia, and then studied for a long time Comet 67P, Churyumov, Gerasimenko.
Sounded good to me. And in that case, Mark Selfridge, longtime listener, first-time winner, is our winner this week. He hails from Boise, Idaho, way up there north. We're going to send him the Planetary Radio T-shirt, a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account. So congratulations, Mark. We'll get that stuff in the mail. As you might expect, I had mail from many other people with interesting comments, including this from Craig Balog in Woodbridge, New Jersey. He said, I believe Rosetta also did observations on a third asteroid named P2010A2, and it helped to confirm that it was an asteroid and not a comet. I guess there was some question about that. It was discovered by Hubble, but I guess Rosetta played a part.
By the Hubble Space Telescope, I assume you mean not Edwin Hubble.
No, not Edwin. Though I'm sure if he was around, he'd claim it, knowing a little bit about
undoubtedly.
His character.
Yeah, that was more a distant observation as opposed to the flybys, which is what I was looking for. But yeah, Rosetta did all sorts of great stuff.
And then endless comments, well, not quite endless, from a lot of people who just talked about how much they were influenced by the Rosetta mission. A couple from Israel, Nadav Mayet, who decided to pursue planetary science because of the mission. Dana Lynn Barnett, who said her three-year-old is a big Rosetta fan, especially of the animation that was done around that mission. And this one from Birko Katerino Ruzica in Germany, who said that she's writing her PhD thesis on the geology and morphology of 67P, and so she's a big fan of Rosetta as well.
Yeah, I bet. Cool.
We're ready for another contest.
All right. For this time, answer the following question. In what region is ESA's Schiaparelli supposed to land? So what region on Mars, region name, or coordinates, or however you choose to convey it in a standardly accepted notation?
And we'll give a special advantage to those of you who are maybe listening to this after that landing. We all hope it'll be successful, and we'll have a leg up on those who enter early. But if you enter, you must do so. You really must by the 25th. That would be Tuesday, October 25th at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And where do they enter?
Planetary.org/radio contest.
Okay. Or you can drop a line to Planetary Radio at planetary.org, which is also where I just welcome your comments about the radio show. And I read all of those, and I try to reply to as many as I can. By the way, the nice people at National Geographic and our guest last week, Andrew Fazekas, the author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. You remember that, right? Well, they've given us another copy of the book to give away. And we'll throw in a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net account, that nonprofit network of worldwide telescopes. We're done.
Ooh. All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about your favorite trace gas. Thank you, and good night.
I was going to say I like radon, but it may not like me. I'm not even sure it's a trace gas, is it?
I don't know. Just move on.
That's Bruce Betts. He's the director of science and technology at the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its ever-voyaging members. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.